Good morning. Sorry for the delay and welcome to the press briefing. Today is Tuesday, 21st of January, we are at the United Nations here in Geneva. I have a few announcements for you, which I'm going to read. And then, as you saw from the announcement of the press briefing, we have quite a few colleagues connected to or here in the room to answer your questions. I suppose everybody's in Davos, so... But people are connecting on Zoom, or thanks for those who made it to the room. So let me start by speaking about, indeed, Davos. Announcement about the travel of the Secretary General. He left New York yesterday to attend the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. Tomorrow, Wednesday, he will be delivering a special address focusing on collaboration for the intelligent age, which is the theme of this year's forum. The remarks of the Secretary General are expected to highlight how, despite progress on many fronts, including technological leaps, many of our world's problems are getting worse. He will call on leaders gathered in Davos to shift their collective efforts into overdrive and to improve collaboration to address two existential threats, the climate crisis and ungoverned artificial intelligence. While at the WEF, the Secretary General is also scheduled to have a series of meetings with leaders from government and the private sector. And then he will go to the annual retreat with the special and personal representatives and envoys, as usual, as every year, and then he will go back to New York. I also have an announcement. Oh, but speaking about Davos, Charlotte Sector asked me to tell you that her boss is in Davos and available for questions or interviews. You can contact her if you need to. Speaking about human rights, going to human rights, I can inform you that the Committee on the Rights of the Child will conclude this afternoon the review of the report of Peru. The countries that they are going to review this week are the Gambia and Ecuador. This morning, the Conference on Disarmament is holding the first public plenary of the 2025 session. This is under the presidency of Italy, which will last until the 14th of February. And then Japan will take the lead on the Conference on Disarmament, followed by Kazakhstan, Kenya, Malaysia, and Mexico. As you know, the presidency of the Conference on Disarmament are rotating on the alphabetical order. This is the first meeting of the 2025 session, which will be divided into three successive parts. So this one, which started yesterday, in fact, will last until the 20th of March. Then we will have the second part from the 12th of May to the 22nd of June, and then the third one from 28th of July to 12th September. So these are the few announcements I had. We have also sent you a few remarks and information about various statements. So I don't know if you have any question for me or for the colleagues who are connected or here in the room. Agnes.
Yes, thank you. Indeed, I have several questions for you or and for Jens as well. So I it's all about reactions. I have two.
Is here in the room. Maybe you want to come to the podium, Jens.
Yes. So two questions on the decisions made by the new U.S. administrations to leave the Paris Agreement and WHO. How that will affect the organization WHO. And maybe a question to Jens on Gaza, on the distribution of aid. So.
Okay, let me start with your first question. First of all, Tariq is supposed to participate in the briefing, so we are waiting for him. He texted me that he was coming in person, so he's on the bus arriving probably very, very soon. So For the comment on WHO, I will defer it to him. On the Paris Agreement, Claire is also online in case she would like to intervene. But what I can tell you is the following. The Paris Agreement was adopted by all the world's nations in 2015 because they recognized the immense harm that climate change is already causing and the enormous opportunity that climate action presents. It offers a meaningful yet flexible framework for action by all countries. The last 10 years have been the hottest in recorded history. We know this. We've been following this here with WMO day by day, I would say. We have to look no farther than Los Angeles to see this human, ecological, and economic disaster play out. The collective efforts under the Paris Agreement have made a difference, but we need to go much farther and faster together. The transformation envisaged in the Paris Agreement is already underway. The Paris Agreement has unleashed an energy revolution, offering unparalleled opportunities for countries and businesses to invest in renewable power that would bring 21st century jobs and prosperity. Leaders must seize this opportunity in this critical decade for climate action. The Secretary General remains confident that cities, states, and businesses within the United States, along with other countries, will continue to demonstrate vision and leadership by working for the low-carbon, resilient economic growth that will create quality jobs and markets for the 21st century prosperity. It is crucial that the United States remains a leader on environmental issues. And on this particular subject, I'd like to give the floor also to Claire, who has, I see she has put her camera on. Claire.
Yes, good morning. Everybody, sorry I can't be with you in the room. So today sees the launch at the World Meteorological Organization of the International Year for Preservation of Glaciers. You are all invited to attend it online or in person. We'll be sending out a press release shortly. Glaciers are melting. Glaciers follow the laws of physics. They are melting, they are retreating. This is going to have major, it's already having, you know, a big effect, short-term hazards. We're seeing more, you know, disasters related, water-related disasters due to this. And it's going to have a major impact on long-term water security. So I think our point would be that, you know, climate change follows the laws of physics, the laws of physics. These are non-negotiable. Climate change, you know, we look at climate change from the perspective of decades, even centuries, you know, rather than a 4 or 5 year, you know, term in office. And it is the, what our Secretary General has said, it is the, you know, the defining challenge of our time. If we want to, and our Secretary General, Celeste Sauro, she's currently en route to Davos. And as you will recall, last week, the World Economic Forum published its annual Global Risks Report. And yet again, environmental risks were very, very prominent in that report, both in the short term, which WEF defines as a 2 year period, and in the longer 10 year term. Extreme weather was the top risk for all sectors, actually, including the business community. And we are seeing, as you know, tragically, we are seeing now in Los Angeles, you know, we're seeing the enormous effect that weather, you know, climate water-related hazards have on every single aspect of our economies and our societies. Just to give you an idea, and I can send you these notes. So according to WMO statistics, extreme weather, water, and climate-related events caused nearly 12,000 reported disasters between 1970 and 2021, with 4 trillion in economic losses. These are estimates. They're probably an underestimate because underreporting of extreme heat. The United States of America accounts for the lion's share of global economic losses from weather, climate, and water-related hazards. And I'm quoting here from US figures. According to the US figures, US has sustained more than 400 weather and climate disasters since 1980, where overall damages or costs exceeded $1 billion. So it's not all the disasters, it's just those which cost more than $1 billion. The total cost of these 403 events exceeds $2.9 trillion. And again, this is according to US figures. Last year in 2024, there were 27 confirmed extreme weather and climate events in the US costing more than $1 billion. Not all of these weather-related disasters, you know, have a connection with climate change. We're not saying that. We never will. We never have done. But climate change is an aggravating factor. It is making our weather much more extreme. So, you know, the need for the Paris Agreement is pretty obvious. We reported two weeks ago that 2024 was the hottest year on record. We temporarily hit the 1.5 degree Celsius level, an estimated 1.15 degrees above the pre-industrial era. So, you know, the need for climate action, the need for the Paris Agreement is more urgent than ever. I think that's probably more than enough.
Absolutely, Claire. Thank you very much for these details. So Tariq has joined me on the podium, but before we go to WHO, is there any other question related to the Paris Agreement of what we have just said? Let me see. I don't see hands in the room, but I see hands on the platform. So I don't know, Catherine and then Beza, is this on the Paris Agreement?
Good morning, Alessandra. It is not on the Paris Agreement. Question for Jens, for Human Rights and UNHCR.
Okay, so we'll take this in a moment. Beza, is that on the Paris Agreement?
No, it's for WHO and UNHCR.
Good. Lisa Schlein?
Yes, while I may have questions on WHO, I do have one on the Paris Agreement.
Go ahead.
I've heard comments that as serious as the U.S. withdrawal may be from the Paris Agreement, that the individual states have been doing, U.S. states, have been doing a great deal of work in terms of climate change and working with the green revolution, with the production of EV cars and all kinds of regulations, and that perhaps this could compensate for the withdrawal of the United States as such, of the federal government, from the Paris Agreement. Do you agree with that? Is this a possibility, or is it sort of a halfway house? Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. As I read in the statement from the Secretary General, we do remain confident that they will continue doing their part. On the exact issue of compensation, I don't know, Claire, if you can say a few words.
I'm not really an expert on that, but I think just to underline that, you know, there is huge momentum at, you know, state level, business level, corporate level. You know, climate change is one of the, you know, the big topics at Davos. Obviously, you know, national governments have a key role to play, but you know, the response to climate change, you know, it's much wider than that. Later this week, it's the International Day of Renewable Energy. I can't remember the exact title, but for that, WMO will be publishing a new report on renewable energy. And you know, the figures on renewables, you know, it's the one beacon of hope in, you know, an otherwise quite gloomy picture. You know, that there is massive investment in renewables, and you know, I think You know, and that will that will carry on. You know, we will not cannot stop the revolution to renewables.
Indeed, the day you are referring to, Clarice, the exact title is International Day of Clean Energy, and is indeed commemorated by the international community on the 26th of January. We will send you the statement of the Secretary General for this day as soon as we have it. Thank you, Claire. I think there are no other questions on the Paris Agreement, so I'll go back to Agnès to ask her question to Tariq, who has joined me on the podium.
Yes, thank you. So the question to WHO was, after the US decision to leave the WHO, what is your reaction and how are you going to reorganize the organization, the fundings, how much that will affect your operations? I imagine you have already looked at it even before today, so maybe you could give us more inputs on what you plan to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Agnes, and sorry for being late. In fact, I have a statement for you, a WHO statement that I will read for you now. The World Health Organization regrets the announcement that the United States of America intends to withdraw from the organization. WHO plays a crucial role in protecting the health and security of the world's people, including Americans, by addressing the root causes of disease, building stronger health systems, and detecting, preventing, and responding to health emergencies, including disease outbreaks, and often in dangerous places where others cannot go. The United States was a founding member of WHO in 1948 and has participated in shaping and governing WHO's work ever since, alongside 193 other member states, including through its active participation in the World Health Assembly and Executive Board. For over seven decades, WHO and the United States of America have saved countless lives and protected Americans and all people from health threats. Together, we ended smallpox, and together we have brought polio to the brink of eradication. American institutions have contributed to and benefited from membership in WHO. With the participation of the United States and other member states, WHO has, over the past 7 years, implemented the largest set of reforms in its history to transform our accountability, cost effectiveness, and impact in countries. This work continues. We hope the United States will reconsider, and we look forward to engaging in constructive dialogue to maintain the partnership between the United States of America and WHO for the benefit of the health and well-being of millions of people around the globe. This statement you will have in your inbox shortly.
Thank you very much, Tariq. And of course, Agnes, I haven't forgotten your question for Jens on Gaza, but I see hands for Tariq on this matter. So I'll start with the room. Nick.
Yeah, thank you. Tariq, what do you think are the implications of this withdrawal for practical cooperation between WHO and key US institutions like CDC? Will that continue, or is that also now a victim of this decision? And I mean, have you had discussions with CDC ahead of this decision? Because as you know, it was foreseen. Thank you.
Thanks, Nick. In fact, we are, as we speak, analyzing the language and exact details of the executive orders to assess what will be implications and impact. So we will probably need some time to make that assessment.
Christiane?
Thank you, Tariq. Can you give us an update on the US contributions, where they stand at the moment? And I understand they are by far the biggest contributor. What are the plans to offset the contribution to the budget that will be missing in a year from now?
Thanks, Alessandra. US is the largest single donor. In 2023, the contribution was 18 million. All the details on the budget, more details is available on our budget portal, so I don't have more details than that. As I said, we are going to analyze what is the impact of this announcement. But you know that we have been already engaged in what we call investment round, trying to diversify the funding and try to have more of sustainable funding for WHO, so we can cover really our general plan of work that is given to us by member states. So member states told us what to do through our plan of work and our strategy. So we hope that that will be properly funded.
Thank you. Oui, Jeremy.
Thank you, Tarek. Talking about numbers, you don't have all the specific numbers, but can you just at least tell us what's the immediate consequences on the budget? I understand that, if I'm correct, the US is barely like nearly $1 billion on the total budget. That is a bit more than $6 billion. So that's 1/6, let's say, of the WHO budget. So how is it affected as of today? Is this budget until 2025 not affected? Is the next one going to be affected? When will you see basically those consequences?
Again, Jeremy, I'm really not sure I cannot respond to you what will happen. So we really have to see. And so as I said, the U.S. was representing 18% of the budget. And sorry if I said something differently just now. So it wasn't 18 million. It was 18% of the budget in 2023. And as I said, the U.S. is the largest single donor. So we have to see really how this will play out. And we need to see what will be the consequences.
There are about 20 questions. We are not going to take them all. I mean, I think, Tarek, you tell me, because I know that, I mean, you've said many things, and we need more time. We take a few more. Okay. So, Agnes, back to you.
Yes, still a follow-up on the question. You talked about engaging to a constructive dialogue on your side. Is WHO already has already taken some steps to look for that dialogue with the new U.S. administration? And could you remind us, because it's not the first time that this is happening, could you remind us what is the actual procedure to leave the organizations, how it works, how long it lasts? It's not something from today to tomorrow. So it's taking months, 1 year? Yes.
So as I said, we are looking forward to a constructive dialogue with the new U.S. administration. The process is that a letter has to be sent to the Secretary General of the United Nations, because UN is the depository of WHO Constitution. From that moment the letter is received, it's 1 year process before the actual withdrawal.
Emma.
Hi, Tarek. What appetite do you have from other donors to plug the gap? Have you already consulted them? Are any willing to step forward? Thank you.
As I said, we had these investment rounds where we really try to get the budget that we need, again, to fulfill the mandate that it's given to us. But in the meantime, we are really continuing our work. Dr. Tedros was, and is still, in Tanzania. You have received the press release yesterday. Dr. Mike Ryan is in Pakistan after his visit in Afghanistan, working there to see how we can improve health, how we can end polio. Our regional director for East Mediterranean is in Syria today, trying to see how we can support health system. We have been briefing you here every day about what we are doing in Gaza, in Yemen, in Sudan, and other places. So we will continue to do that.
I'll go to the platform. So Katrin was the first one, I think. Yep, Katrin.
Yes, my question was more for Jens and UNHCR.
Oh, okay, okay, let's go.
Tarek said that, I'm sorry, Tarek spoke about US contribution, 18% of the budget, 18% of which amount? Thank you.
I really have to check. Really, you know that we have this biennium budget, so I have to see what was the exact amount for the previous biennium. But again, in 2023, US was contributing with 18%. Again, all this information is really available in a budget portal. You can just go there, click by contributors, and you get a list of contributors, even in general or per specific topics.
And I think we have all received now the statement that Tariq read, so it's in your mailbox. Beyza.
Thank you, Alexandra. Actually, my question was already asked by colleagues, but I just want to ask that you already said that you're looking for different contribution, but also will in contact with the Trump administration. Do you hopeful that this decision will be withdrawn and they will return to the table and be part of the WHO? Thank you.
Sorry, I think it's really in our statement there. It's like we hope that the United States will reconsider, and we really hope that there will be constructive dialogue for the benefit of everyone, for Americans, but also for people around the world.
Thank you, Tariq. I continued. You tell me. You have exhausted your answers. Stéphane Boussard.
Yeah, hello. Thank you very much indeed. I still have a question about, you were talking about the WHO working on a more sustainable way of funding the organization. I think WHO started, like other UN agencies, some kind of replenishment conferences or replenishment process. Could you say a few words about that, and to what extent could that really improve WHO funding? Thank you.
Thanks. Well, Stefan, you know, you are here during the World Health Assembly, and you know how many resolutions are being made, how many decisions are taken, and if you look at our general plan of work, it's there really so many things inside, and we really need to be able to finance those programs and those asks from member states. What we are really looking for is to have enough money, but also the money that we could really use in a way that it's most appropriate to execute that work. So that work has been going as the transformation of WHO to make it more accountable and more cost-effective organization. So we will continue to do that.
Thank you very much, Tariq. Tian Yusun, the Guangmin Daily.
Tariq, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, hello. Okay, first question. Before President Trump officially announced the United States withdrawal from the WHO yesterday, had the WHO received the period notice or indication from the President Trump himself or his staff? The second question, it is well known that the withdrawing from the WHO requires a one-year waiting period. During this year, will the WHO engage in further dialogue or negotiations with the U.S. government to restore the partnership? If so, what will be the focus on these discussions? After the United States withdrawal becomes official, can the WHO ensure that its collaboration in health research, vaccine development, and data sharing will remain uninterrupted? Thank you. That's all.
Thank you. So as I said, we are just looking into executive orders, and it came overnight, as you know. But we are going to engage, and we are looking forward to dialogue. There is lots of areas for cooperation. And just to give you a little bit of sense of what WHO is doing, we are really evidence-based organization. So we have number of expert groups in various fields, and we are looking into science. We are really trying to see what's the latest scientific research showing and how that can be translated in the best possible recommendations for ministries of health for all countries. And we will continue to do that. So research is vital. We need research, and we need really research that is free of vested interest to give us collectively the best possible options for public health policies that will then improve health of everyone.
Thank you, Tariq. I'll take two more questions. John Zarokostas.
Good morning, Tariq. Just a little clarification from what you mentioned earlier. Do we have any idea what is the breakdown from the assessed contributions of the US to the budget of the WHO, and how much of the US contributes to the earmarked voluntary contributions? I think their share is far bigger in that component, but I stand to be corrected.
John, I don't really have figures with me, but I'm happy to look for it and answer it to you.
I think that would be of interest from what I see from everybody else. Lisa, you had a question on WHO.
Yes, I do. Good morning, Tariq. Could you speak specifically about the potential consequences, impacts of the U.S. withdrawal from the WHO on the situation in developing countries, in particular countries in conflict such as Sudan, where you're already terribly underfunded and having great difficulty in accessing people who are in need of health? Thank you.
Sorry, I can't tell you exactly the consequences. We are going to look into it by looking in what executive orders say. We will definitely analyze that. But I've been briefing you on Sudan a few days ago, and then we all know how difficult the situation is there. And we all know that all the agencies, and Jens is there to confirm, that we don't get the funding we need. Besides funding, we need access as well to Sudan. But we need to once we have the access, to be able to bring what is needed. So we will be looking. But at the same time, as I said, we will continue to work, and we will do our best to be in all those places so we protect most vulnerable and be there where people need us the most.
Tariq, if you allow me, I think there is a last question from Satoko. I should never say last. Satoko.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I have a question about the investment round. So far, WHO has reached the half of the target of the $7.1 billion. And I'm wondering if WHO members have to agree on consensus whether the investment round funding to be used to fill the gap of the US funding suspension. And then this issue will be discussed at the upcoming executive board meeting. Thank you.
Well, it's up to member states to decide what will be discussed at the executive board, as it is the case for the other meeting, and including on investment around. But again, it's too early to say what are the consequences. We need really to look into it. What are the implications? But we will continue our work in trying really to get that funding that we need.
Tariq, would you take a couple more questions? Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Tariq. Has the letter been received by the Secretary General yet? And has the clock started ticking? Maybe Alessandra, you know. And does that mean that there's still maybe wiggle room to negotiate if it hasn't been sent? Thank you.
Emma, we found the information was found this morning, and New York is sleeping. The best of my knowledge, no, but I'm expecting some kind of declaration today from New York. Laurent, your hand had been put down and then is up now again. Is that for Tariq? And then we really go to Gaza.
Thanks. It's a quick follow-up from one of Tenu's questions, because Tariq, you didn't really understand on the fact to know whether WHO learned about the executive order when it was announced by President Trump, or was there any pre-notification, informal engagement by the incoming administration with the DG? Thank you.
Well, what I can tell you is that I have seen the executive order this morning, like everyone else, and we need to have a look at it.
Tariq, thank you so much for coming in person to the briefing and give us this announcement. As I said, it's in your mailbox. There is also in the chat to the briefing some data from Claire on the issue of climate change that you had asked for. So yeah, it's right there. So thank you very much, Tariq. I turn now to Jens.
Sorry, does Tariq have something also potentially to contribute on Gaza? So.
Oh, maybe, I don't know, I'll say that, because yeah, if this is the case, I think that, as I told you at the beginning, there are several people who are connected or in the room, so you can ask questions, of course, on other subjects. And Agnes, you had a question on Gaza, and Catherine also had other questions. So let's go to Jens, and I'll give the floor to Agnes first.
Yes, so the question was to Jens, but maybe others can also answers if they want. It's a question on the logistic of the distributions of aid in Gaza. We were wondering, what can you tell us about how the aid gets in? We are seeing about the trucks, but who is getting the aid into Gaza? Who coordinated the operations? And in particular, who is ensuring the security of these distributions? And have you seen any looting, or do you fear any looting? Either any armed gangs who are diverting the aid. So what can you tell us about that? Thank you.
Thank you, Agnes and Tariq. You're going nowhere. WHO is going nowhere. I just want to say from our perspective, we stand fully behind the statement that we have just heard. And I think it's worth remembering that the world lives longer, healthier, perhaps a little bit happier because of WHO. So I noted that Tariq mentioned that WHO is in places where others cannot go. And that is exactly where we need meet our colleagues from WHO, in Gaza, in Yemen, in Afghanistan, everywhere.
In Sudan.
It is an indispensable part of the international humanitarian system, and they will remain so. To Gaza and what is going on there. Let me give you some language that I have. Of course, it is a new situation. I think we will all remember Sunday, 19th January. Sigh of relief. At long last, aid at scale is entering. At long last, more hostages were released and can be reunited with their families. And at long last, women and minors were freed from detention. It's a tremendous hope. It was fragile, but vital. This deal must hold. The world will not understand if it doesn't. Of course, no one should underestimate the complexities ahead. Just thinking of the rubble inside Gaza that needs to be removed and the clearance of unexploded remnants of war. We are working with the guarantors of the deal and Israel to get supplies in. And on the ground, we engage with local authorities and communities, one day at a time. The search was prepared. Hundreds of trucks have entered. They started a few minutes after the deal entered into force on Sunday. We have to and we will maximize delivery through this opening. Hunger is widespread. People are homeless. Disease. Injuries are rampant, children are separated, and there's a cloud of deep psychological trauma hanging over Gaza that needs to be dealt with. Our priorities are clear. Getting food in, opening bakeries, getting health care, restocking hospitals, repairing water networks, repairing shelter, family reunification. A lot of the things that we have done throughout, but nowhere near at the scale needed. And that is what we hope and work towards to be able to do now. I do not, to your question, have any solid numbers about distribution. We know that the aid has entered. A lot of it is in warehouses. There's also, we need to bear in mind, there's a lot of population movements. People are moving. They are able to return home. I'm sure you have seen the images of people going home. It's a bit of a stretch of the imagination, I would say, to call them homes, because mostly, particularly in the north, In the north, it's mountains of rubble that they find. So they need help with that. In terms of security, as I mentioned, we work with, of course, the Israelis on getting stuff in and the other guarantors of the deal, and we work with local authorities and the communities themselves inside Gaza. Up till now, these two first days of entry, there has been no reports of looting or attacks against aid workers that I have seen. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you so much. As you mentioned, with the ceasefire, many people in Gaza returning to their home, but they are just facing rubble. Now we are experiencing winter conditions. Where these people will stay in a short term, and does the United Nations have a plan for sheltering these people?
Well, as has been the case throughout these 15 months of relentless warfare, people have been sheltering in collective sites. A lot of UNRWA schools, UNRWA facilities have been used for that. Shelter material has gone in. You will have seen the tents that are there, and people are building their own shelters with whatever is at hand. So part of the search here is to get shelter in. It's cold. It's needed, so that's very clear. And the sooner the better. There's not a moment to lose.
Yes, Emma.
Hi, Jens. Thanks for briefing us. Can you explain what has changed that has allowed so much aid to come in? What new crossings have opened? How it's been possible just to get so quickly from 50 trucks a day to 900? And can you say a little bit more about the dangers of unexploded ordnances as people go back to their homes, please? Thank you. Or what's left of them.
Thank you. What changed was the deal that came into effect, and that was struck. So that's of course the fundamental change. There has been, as we have called for, simultaneous openings of crossings both in the north and in the south. So that is extremely welcome. Whereas in the past we have seen when one opened, another was closed, and it was this dribble that came in from different parts, where we have called for a very long time to have simultaneous opening over land, both to the north and to the south. And that is what we are seeing these past couple of days. The dangers with unexploded ordnance in this conflict, as in many other conflicts, is of course that it's there, and it is extremely dangerous. We know that this ordnance, this remnants of war, can last for very, very long time, decades. So, of course, there needs to be a concerted, coordinated effort to clean that up. For the safety and security of all civilians, including aid workers working in Gaza now.
Thank you. Sorry. Nick.
Yeah, thank you. Jens, I just wonder, can you confirm, are all the openings, the pre-October 7 border crossing openings, are they functioning now? Are we seeing the pipeline open from Jordan and other places that were requested but not possible in the past? Have you seen also any loosening of the kind of categories of assistance you're allowed to bring in, dual-use items, pipes for water, infrastructure, that kind of stuff, which has been a problem in the past? Is that now moving in? Is the screening much more relaxed than previously? And a question for Tariq. I wonder if you could bring us up to date a little bit on what aid is reaching which hospitals in Gaza, and specifically, what have you found in the north? And thank you.
Let's start with Jens.
Yeah, thank you, Nick. Of course, this search has been prepared for a very long time in anticipation of an opening. So there has been a massive mobilization, if you like, of aid outside. Regarding openings, there are openings simultaneously open in the north and in the south. All aid that is coming in is screened. It is screened. That regime that was in place before remains in place.
Tariq?
Yeah, thanks. Well, Nika, you have heard from our representative, Dr. Pieper-Korn. We have a 60-day operational plan to restore and expand health services, and this is priority. What does it mean? It means basically now health workers are going to health facilities, seeing what can be done in those places and how we can restore some of the services, whether in those facilities or we would be bringing prefab clinics to be used. But the idea is really to, as quickly as possible, try to provide health facilities to people of Gaza, focusing on emergency care, maternal and child health, and other areas. So half of hospitals are not functional, others are partially functional, and majority of health facilities sustain some sort of damage. So the idea is really to restore health services as fast as possible, then to assess the damages on existing health facilities and see how we can put them in use. But we should not forget other areas, and that's that 12,000 patients still need to be evacuated outside Gaza. We need to make sure that those people can go and receive medical care they need. We've been talking to you, 25,000 people have sustained life-changing injuries. These people need rehabilitation services that are not available right now. So really, it's and we need really to think about health workers in Gaza. We estimate there were around 20,000 health workers before. We don't know how many there are now. These people have gone themselves with their families through multiple displacements and through the war. We need to make sure that they first feel safe and they feel recognized so they can go back to their places of work and try to provide those services. In the meantime, we will continue with deployment of emergency medical teams to support Gaza health workers.
Let me go to the platform, Catherine.
Thank you, Alessandra. My question is about Syria. So I don't know if questions
to,
are
to Jens, you mean?
Yes, to Jens and also human rights.
Human rights is not with us today, I'm afraid, but you can ask your question to Jens. And yeah, more or less, and then I'm sure there will be other questions on Gaza, but if colleagues don't mind, let's ask the question, Syria, Catherine, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Alessandra. Good morning, Tariq, and good morning, Jens. My question is related to the reconstruction of Syria. French President Macron announced a couple of weeks ago that a meeting would take place at the end of January in France. So do you have any information on that? And have you been invited? And also, I'd like to speak about, but this is more an issue for human rights. It's a pity that they're not attending the briefing, towards women, because we see a lot of reporting about women not allowed to walk into the streets without being totally covered. And I'd like to know if these kind of topics have been addressed by UN agencies, human rights, and even United Nations in New York, Alessandra. And I had a question for you regarding the retreat. You spoke about the retreat that the SG is gonna have with the heads of agencies. When is it going to take place? And I suppose that it's going to take place as usual in Switzerland, Canton de Vaud.
Okay.
Thank you.
Maybe I'll start with the last one. Yes, the retreat is going to take place in Switzerland. And that is what I can say about that. The OHCHR in Syria, I would refer you, I will definitely forward your question to the colleagues, but I would also refer you to the statement that High Commissioner Turk made at the end of his mission to Syria. There were a few issues that would answer your question on that. On Syria, maybe Jens, you have anything to add in terms of reconstruction and
No, I've, you know, reconstruction is not really our mandate. But just to reiterate, basically, on the other part of your question to on human rights, we also reiterate that all international human rights laws and conventions should be upheld by the new Syrian authorities.
Absolutely, and but really, I think when High Commissioner Turk was there, he spoke at length about that. Let me see who's got the next question. Is Beza?
My question is for the UNHCR or IOM. Maybe I can wait for that.
Is it about the Middle East? Is it about it? Because normally we should have Kennedy online.
Is it about Trump administrations?
Do you mind if we wait for, let's finish with the humanitarian issues and then I'll see if Kennedy's there and if he can answer you. Lisa, you had a question on Syria or Gaza for our colleagues?
It's kind of on Gaza, right? For both, for Jens and Tarek, if you want to participate, just very quickly, what is the likely impact of Israel barring UNRWA from providing aid and in Gaza? And I'm also wondering what has happened to, I've forgotten his name, but there was a doctor, the head of a hospital in Gaza, who has been detained or had been detained by Israel. What is his fate? Do you know about his whereabouts? Has he been released or is he still detained? Thank you. And I'm wondering whether from Tarek, perhaps, whether Dr. Pieper Korn and other health professionals that you've had who've regularly gone into Gaza will have a more difficult time in doing this because of the with U.S. Withdrawal from WHO. Thank you.
Okay, let's take this one by one. First of all, I think we have been extensively speaking about the fact that UNRWA is absolutely irreplaceable in our work, humanitarian work with the Palestinian refugees. The Secretary General has consistently stated this. We have distributed to you the remarks of Commissioner General Philippe Lazzarini to the press conference that he held on the 17th of January after briefing the Security Council. So I think it is absolutely clear that the fact that if UNRWA had to be barred from delivering its essential work, it would be a disaster, really. We need UNRWA to support international response in this very important moment. And again, it is totally irreplaceable. Jens, I'll give you the floor on this and the other questions from Lisa, and then if Tarek also wants to intervene. On the doctors, I'm not sure if we have answers, but we listen from colleagues. Jens.
Yeah, thanks. And hi, Lisa. On the doctor, I do not have any information on that. On UNRWA, a little bit closer to the ground and in practical terms, when we are, and that reaches back to Agnes' question earlier about distribution, how the aid that is now coming in is going to get out to people. Who do you think are going to do that? UNRWA staff is going to help with that. There are hundreds of them. They have, as they have had throughout this conflict, the close relationship, the network, the historical kind of presence that is crucial for distributing aid work, aid assistance, the last mile. So they're certainly going to be part of that.
And just to give you an idea of the extent of the services that UNRWA provides, they provide services, really key primary services as healthcare, education, social support to 5.9 million Palestinian refugees in the Israeli-occupied Palestinian territories, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. It is almost 6 million refugees that are allowed to have these very primary services thanks to UNRWA. So it's absolutely impossible to replace it in these functions. Tariq.
Well, I also don't have any information on Dr. Abu Safia and director of Kamal Adwan Hospital. And Alexander already mentioned how important UNRWA is from the health point of view. With 1,000 health workers, UNRWA handles over 16,000 medical consultations per day, including for childhood vaccination, maternal health services, malnutrition screening, and mental health support. So I think we all have said many times that no one can match that and no one can replace UNRWA.
And I would also, maybe just to finish on this subject, draw your attention to what the Commissioner General said on this press conference. He said dismantling UNRWA now outside the political process will undermine the ceasefire agreement, sabotage Gaza recovery, and political transition. Okay, so Beza is on the other subject, so I'll go to Satoko.
Hello.
Go ahead.
My question is actually to Jens on Gaza. Could you talk about the problem of looting humanitarian aid by armed group gangs in Gaza? How are you tackling this problem since ceasefire? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. As you know, there has been a sad, tragic history of looting happening. Except the past 2 days, we have not seen any looting. We have not seen any organized armed gangs or group, whatever you want to call them, attacking the aid that is coming in. I think it's important to see this in the wider picture as to why were these gangs there in the first place. Because whatever came into Gaza, whatever, had extremely high value. So there was incentives to do that. Now, of course, the more aid that comes in, let's see, those incentives will probably not be there as much. That's why we were talking about flooding the place with aid, right? Because it takes that incentive away. That does not take away from when things do something that's illegal or criminal or violent, you know, they should be, you know, it should be addressed. Head on. We have seen in the past that Israeli attacks against the Palestinian police has for a long period of time effectively put them out of function, out of service. So that didn't exist. We had collaboration with local communities where there were some measure of safety and security provided by them to the areas we were passing through or where deliveries were made. We have also seen instances in the past that these people were attacked. So it has been sad. The good news is, as I mentioned, we have not seen these incidents the past couple of days. And hopefully that will continue this way.
Let's hope it holds. Gunile.
Yes, thanks for taking my question. It's to Tariq. It's about 12,000 medical evacuations. What has happened there? Have you prepared? Have you been able to evacuate? What are your plans? Where would they be able to be taken out? And how do you prioritize? Thanks.
Hi, Gunilla. I can send you later. We have a really, our colleagues developed a really nice infographic describing the process of medical evacuations from making a priority list, having this list approved by the ministry of health, then this list being sent to the authorities, to the Israeli authorities for the approval, and then we need to find the country that is willing to. So it's a long process. So we really need to make sure that this starts working again, because since the closure of Rafah border, we only had I think around 500 people being evacuated, while before that, before May, there were a couple of thousands. So we need to get this to make sure that people who are on the list, who are already identified, and we have people who are injured during military operations, but also people with the chronic diseases, those who identified as really needing, who cannot receive health services they need in Gaza to be evacuated.
Thanks. Catherine, I think your question was something else. So I'll go to Antonio and then come back to Beza and you. Antonio.
Thank you, Alessandra. So my question is to IOM and UNHCR on the decision.
Okay. Let's wait 1 second then. I'll thank, if there are no other questions for Jens and Tariq. Okay, Nick.
Just a quick one for Tariq. It would be great if I could get an accurate number of the number of medical evacuations since the Rafah crossing closed.
Yep, I will definitely send this.
Thank you very much. So, Jens, Tariq, thank you so much for being here this morning. I'll go to Kennedy first. Let me see if he's still online, hopefully. Yes, Kennedy is online. So if you could just open your video, please, Kennedy. And do we have anybody from UNHCR? Yes, we do. Shabia should be online. Let me see if she's still there. Yes, so both of them are here. So Beza, go ahead, ask your question to IOM and or UNHCR, I don't know.
Thank you so much. Yeah, both of them, if it's possible. Yesterday, President Trump said all illegal entry to the country will immediately be halted. Also, he said he will send troops to the southern border to what he called repel the disastrous invasion. I want to ask how both agencies evaluate those remarks. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Beza. So I'll give the floor to Kennedy first and then to Shabia.
Yeah, thank you very much, Beza. As you're aware, some of the executive orders that came in are on this situation, and many more have been pretty much vast. Our team here in IOM, we are pretty much in the process of providing and analyzing the executive orders to basically see the implication this has on our work. And I think you'll bear with us at this moment. Once we have a more in-depth analysis of what this means, then we should be able to provide a feedback to you. But at the moment, our team is still, of course, in the process of just providing an analysis of what implication this has since the document just came out. Thanks.
Shabia, would you like to add anything on UNHCR side?
Thank you, Alessandra. Thank you, colleagues. Just to reiterate what Kennedy has just said as well, on this side, we're also currently reviewing the new executive order and other, and aware of other potential measures, but we'll have to wait for that to happen and then come back to you. Thanks.
Catherine?
Yes, thank you, Alessandra. Good morning to both of you. Yeah, my question was related to the decision of President Trump to end asylum. So, I mean, Shabia answered, in fact, my question. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Catherine. Antonio.
Well, I had more or less the same question. I don't know if you are already doing something in the border with Mexico, any practical movements there by your agencies. I guess it should be an emergency for you, and you should act instead of waiting. No,
Kennedy, would you like to react to that?
Sorry, just to jump into this. Yes, in terms of reacting, we normally, I mean, our work has always been ongoing in terms of supporting migrants in vulnerable situations. So what we are in the process of doing is basically analyzing what implication this will have. But at the moment, our work in supporting migrants, that has always been our mandate, and is something that we'll be continuing to do to ensure, of course, orderly, safe, and humane migration. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both colleagues. So, yes, Nick.
Thanks. I have a question for Shabir. A bunch of questions really relating to the situation of Uyghurs in Thailand who are being threatened with deportation to being sent back to China. I wonder if you could confirm how many Uyghurs there are actually in detention in Thailand at the moment and whether you have yet had any assurance from the Thai government that they will not be sent back. Thank you.
Thank you. Shabir?
Thanks, Nick, for your question. I'll have to check with colleagues on that. I'm not really covering that thematic, so if you allow us, we'll get back to you after the briefing. Thanks.
Okay, well, if you could also just get some sense of what you're actually doing to prevent this repatriation. 2015, there was another big one, more than 100 were sent back. So, yeah, we'd like some detail on what action is being taken to try and avert this again. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nick. I think Shabir has listened to you. If there are no other questions in the room or online, I thought it was going to be a brief briefing, but it's never a brief briefing. So I thank you very, very much for following us. We will definitely, I've got a feeling that we will rediscuss all this in the next days, very soon. So, let me wish you a very good afternoon, and we will see each other on Friday morning. Thanks.